Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Ging gang gong da doo gong da laga raga. My name is Eric. I'm here with Michael for okay, go to the chorus. Go to the chorus.
Yeah, Excision and The Loved Ones.
Those are the two. Those are the two we're doing.
That's what we're doing.
Beautiful, beautiful fucking movies. I don't know really what the tie-in with the two things is, other than you said they would be good and they were really good. That's really enough for me. I don't know if you want to expand on that. Or...
You know, I'm gonna go. I'm gonna chalk it up to Blood, Ladies, and Obsession.
That's okay. That's every week of double feature.
I was gonna say. I mean, we can pretty much chalk it up to that every week.
I want to let people know that this week on the show we have chapters so that they can skip over what I'm about to say. But also, there's going to be spoilers, so you should probably skip the movies you haven't seen. But the fucking thing that has put me in such a good mood is that I don't have to ask people to go to our Kickstarter page.
Yeah, this is...
That's pretty good.
Although we've, come out with, I guess, two shows since the Kickstarter has performed, this is the first time that we are in a world...
In a world where your Kickstarter has been successful.
Right, right. Your In a World voice is getting pretty good, by the way.
Thank you.
I wanted to compliment you.
After Don LaFontaine died, I ate his heart, and now I have his powers.
Oh, I'm so glad this show gets to keep going. How could the internet be without? We get to keep going. We made it. It happened. Can you believe that?
No,
is the real answer.
Still
right?
No.
Yeah. Every phase of the way. So we got funded, and then I was worried that between the time when we got funded and when the funding drive ended, people would unsubscribe, unpledge. So that freaked me out. And then I'm freaked out now because people's credit cards aren't working. Every step of the way, I'm going to be freaked out. Until the next step, I guess. There's really only one more step. But thank you. I cannot thank people enough for they paid for our thing. I mean, that's
I know,
amazing.
It's ridiculous. And we're going to reward them not only with this week's show, but also next week's, the following, 3 weeks, and then an entire year to follow that.
God, I can't believe that.
We're out of movies, though, which is the problem. We didn't plan. We didn't plan on having to come up with more movies.
At what point was it a reality to you that we would do another year of the show?
What time is it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Ask me again when we hit year 6. But yeah, I wasn't really prepared to write a schedule. I guess that's the thing we have to do now.
Yeah.
And we kind of fucked ourselves because now it's going to take even more time than usual. Yeah. I think that was the opposite of the plan.
Well, whatever.
But no, it's great. I'm really glad we got funded. I'm glad everything's working out. Now we just got to put all the things in motion. It'll probably take us a few weeks to get our fucking act together and figure out what this is going to look like. But it's great, and I'm really excited about it. So thanks again to everybody who did that. I want to talk about it more, but another week. There's a lot to talk about already with the film-type things going on.
Oh, yeah,
the show.
Double feature. It's a show, a podcast, nonetheless, that talks about films.
Spoils films using chapters. That's not true.
We spoil our listeners with our chapters.
So let's start with Excision. By writer-director Richard Bates Jr.
Yeah. Who, is that where you start with Excision?
I mean, I don't know anything else about Richard Bates Jr., and okay. I'm really glad he made Excision, so I just felt the need to say, hey, look, writer-directors doing good things.
So Excision for me was, you know how you now, but also me as well, as horror people, I don't know if you've ever done this, but sometimes you do that thing where you go, I need to see new horror, and horror movies are all bad.
Right.
So you Google something like 10 best horror movies you didn't see.
Totally.
Or 10 best new horror films. And without fail, the list comes up and it's 9 movies you've seen that you thought were terrible and one that you've never heard of.
Yep.
Excision was the one I'd never heard of.
Yeah, I was going to ask you where the fuck you found this, because you have this magical talent to find these things that I don't have. And furthermore, that I can't ask other people. And I didn't know if that's just, you know, you and I have seen so many of the same movies, even prior to the show, but for the show now, that maybe our tastes have just lined up so well, or I don't know what's going on, but yeah. You find these. This was just a random internet search that brought you to this.
I don't remember. I think I read about it. I saw the DVD at this weird comic book / DVD rental place that's near my apartment.
There's no such thing as a DVD rental anymore. It's all LA Tan / DVD rental.
Right, exactly. So
that's the name of a Chicago business, not a California business, strangely.
And I remember doing that thing where you text it to yourself and then you go, what is this? And you delete it.
Right.
But then I think it popped up on a list. James Gunn might have posted about it. Someone told me again, and it was that thing where two points cross and suddenly it's a thing you need to see.
Right.
Honestly, all I knew about it was that it had something to do with periods.
Great. Great. Modern horror film has something to do with periods.
So immediately, and I don't think that this is going to be the last comparison we get, but I had these visions of a film that was going to be like May.
Yeah, I got a little bit of that vibe.
But maybe a little bit more sexually driven.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong.
Well, May was pretty sexually driven, or at least how I remember
exactly.
It.
That's what I mean. And this movie had its weird sexual moments. I mean, it had the whole virginity where she and the period thing.
Right.
But that was that wasn't the focus.
Well, also the way the movie starts, right?
Right. Yeah, that's true. But I don't. So I say that wasn't really the focus because I'm about to ask you a very difficult question.
Great.
What's the focus?
What is the focus of Excision? All right. So we have our central female protagonist.
Right.
Words that just flow so naturally out of my mouth when we talk about it's central female protagonist when we talk about horror movies on Double Feature. And we're dealing with her inability to fit in, her trouble in her family unit.
Right.
And this obsession that she has. So I guess if I had to point to anything, I would say Excision, play on incision, obsession with surgery.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the area I go.
Yeah, it's weird because I want to say that this film is almost static in its characters. You get all these characters, you're thrown into this world where these characters have been interacting for, you know, 18 years or whatever, however old she is.
Right, right.
And none of the characters are surprised by pretty much anything anyone does until the end of the film.
Right, you're coming into their world.
And granted, obviously things are, it's showing things come to a head.
Mm-hmm.
Things are getting more and more tense at home. But these are things that if we were to be building the universe with the film,
right,
I don't know if I would be able to suspend my disbelief enough to believe this character can function in a family unit.
Yeah, it seems that their interactions are pretty, you know, if you just came across this person, it's really abrasive. But to grow up around them, it seems natural to these people, almost unfazed.
Yeah, and the other thing that I thought was a very bold move with the film is we kind of get a glimpse into this family where they have the perfect little girl, but she's sick.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a perfectly healthy older daughter who is also sick.
Right.
And you're kind of getting this idea that wouldn't it be nice if one of them was all the sick and the other one was all the great?
Is that an idea you're getting?
I think
terrible person, Michael Kessler.
I think that's what the parents are thinking.
Yeah, right.
They don't wish either daughter was dead, but they wish that all the bad was in one daughter.
Yeah, sure.
Because it'd be easier to dislike that character.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing that's interesting to me is this character should be entirely unlikable because she's a horrible, weird version of a human that instead of being unlikable, somehow has this backwards anti-heroic charisma that you end up rooting for.
Yeah, when you say unlikable, that my gut instinct is to stand up for her.
Right.
Like when you see people go up against her in the film, to feel as if she's your friend and that you don't want bad things to happen. You're rooting for her.
Mm-hmm.
Not even in an anti-hero sense, but just in a, I don't know, we were all young and fucking awkward sense.
Right.
You know, there's the first jump rope scene.
Yeah.
I feel genuinely bad for her.
Yeah.
She has this, she does this thing, and this is how I feel in my social interactions too, where I want to pat myself on the back anytime I have a conversation with a stranger, walk away, and it wasn't the most awkward fucking thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
In my head, I go, you know, it's like achievement unlocked, successful social interaction.
Yeah.
You know what? No one realized I was fucking crazy for the last 5 minutes. This is great. And she does that with the girl who's jumping rope. She says hi, she introduces herself, makes small talk, it's not weird, they look each other in the eyes. And the girl jumping rope is kind of just dickish to her.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I mean, that it makes me feel like, wow, what a fucking jerk. And look, you even pulled off the social interaction and no one's rewarding you for it.
Yeah.
Those moments happen a lot. And I don't know where that identifying with the character... I mean, there's simple stuff like trying to talk to another person or talking to her sister. You can watch that and you can go, I identify with this human being.
Mm-hmm.
But then you see her have these explicit, fucked up kind of dreams.
Yeah.
Do you identify with her there or do you go, okay, this is a monster?
I think, you know, for me, those dreams are so interesting because they're twofold for me. You get this horrendously violent and obscene scenario. Let's just go for the throat and go for that abortion thing.
Yeah.
So you get that really fucking bizarre abortion scene juxtaposed against this character looking gorgeous, like out of some Tarsem Singh movie.
Sure.
And so if this is her dream, you are forced to grapple with the idea that this is something in an ideal world for her, right? Because mm-hmm. she looks that way. And in an ideal universe, of course, you look like, well, obviously you look like Tarsem Singh is directing your life.
Right.
So.
But she wants to look, you know, pretty and perfect. And
right.
She wants to look a societal standard of perfect.
Sure.
But at the same time, in these dreams, she's not doing things that society would even accept, let alone glamorize.
Let alone watch in a film.
Well, sure. But I mean, there's this strange dual thing happening. Maybe it's the fact that she can perform actions that are comfortable for her, that she, you know, has interest in, and at the same time look glamorous to normal people.
Well, I think what it is that the character is almost sociopathic in her lack of desire to fit in.
Right.
She is comfortable outside of a social norm.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she cares that what she's into is weird.
Sure.
I think she has a bent respect for authority that isn't broken. And I think that is the only thing keeping her in check, because I don't think she gives a shit what people think about her peers. She doesn't care about.
Right.
Take a perfect example is the way she approached having sex with that guy.
Right.
She goes up to him, tells him, hey, I would like to have sex with you. Here is my phone number. And then she intentionally sets him up to go down on her while she's on her period.
Right.
He gets upset with that. He freaks out and she just kind of walks away like, whatever, I'm fine with you.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care if you don't like me. I've gotten what I need from you.
It's not as part of a trap or a ruse of any kind. It's just that's what she wanted. And
yeah.
She didn't care about the social repercussions of that.
Exactly. And so maybe in these dreams, the ideal world is that she's able to carry that out in a perfectly social norm.
Yeah, sure.
Which is just, honestly, man, the dreams for me going through this film, they jar me so much.
Sure.
The film's pacing is so, it's tame and the kind of drama is almost akin to something like American Beauty.
Right.
Where it's deep and it's rooted, but it doesn't. I don't cringe. I just go, man,
sure.
Family life can suck.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, this abortion happens and right. Suddenly I'm just so taken aback thinking, okay, well, when this movie plays out, there's no way that it's going to get to that point, right?
Sure, sure. Well, let's stick on the dream sequences for a second, but I'm also still not done with figuring out what the hell Pauline So yeah. We'll come back to that too. Maybe if we kind of explore these other areas, we'll have a bit more of an answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
But it starts you out with these dream sequences, and they're Repo the Genetic Opera type of weird from, you know, the treatment of blood against a comical blue grid background.
Yeah.
It's invoking a hospital theme, but it's mm-hmm. in a very theatrical sense. I mean, when you mentioned the Tarsem Singh kind of style, you're not saying, you know, glamorous and pretty like Mean Girls. You're saying like that dark artsy shit we just saw on the show the other week,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
And so the movie starts in probably as an abrasive place as any with this, what I guess is bleeding, chaotic slaughter next to orgasm.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. I mean, my head's spinning when right. that scene's going on. I don't know what the fuck is happening.
Yeah.
But using the context clues the rest of the movie provides, I think I can go back, having only seen it one time, and go, that's probably what was going on there.
Sure.
But climbing over the half-headed, yeah. severed, awkward body thing and the tub of blood over the nude body. Oh, the style and the mood of these sequences. And every time she wakes up from them and she has a smile, and I don't know, I always wonder when we're talking about these, and I had the same problem back when we talked about Hostel, that I get all excited over what the movie's doing and that by getting excited, I look like a sociopath.
Yeah.
But after 5 long years, I'm over that. I get excited for her. I'm very yeah, happy for
sure.
her. She wakes up from the dream. And as a rational person, I look at it and go, yeah, that was pretty fucked up. Oh, but she's smiling. Good for her.
Yeah.
Because she had a pleasant dream. I hope she has a good day.
Well, and if you want to take that and do kind of a backwards extrapolatory experiment.
Always.
If you take the actor that's playing Pauline,
mm-hmm.
Annalyn McCord is her name.
Yeah.
The roles that she has accepted in television. Are you familiar?
She's on the new 90210, isn't
right.
she?
Right. She's like the sexy vixen in 90210.
Yeah.
And she was one of the really hot sexual characters in Nip Tuck.
Sure.
So anybody walking into this film with any sort of background in those shows, which honestly, I had none. But,
sure.
you know, homework being homework.
Right.
You're walking into this seeing Annalyn McCord, the hot blonde bombshell.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she's waking up from a wet dream, you're immediately going, but she's hot. So was that hot?
Right. Right. Well, again, back to our classic Hostel 2 problem. You know, I'm probably thinking of a lot of Hostel 2 because of Roger Bart.
Yeah.
Who plays Bob in yeah. this movie. So let me explain to you. You've delivered this movie to me on a silver platter here to enjoy during my weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if I'm going to a place and I'm wondering if I'm going to have a good time. And then I walk in and I see my friend Roger mm-hmm. Bart there. You know, it's just added bonus. Like, oh, well, Roger Bart's here. This place, first of all, I like Roger
oh, yeah.
Bart. We'll have a fine time catching up. And also, he came to this place. So maybe, you know, maybe he knows what he's doing.
Sure.
But it's one after another in this movie. John Waters as a fucking priest again.
Yep.
I mean, you have to be, and Tracy Lords from Crybaby, mm-hmm. you have to be fucking kidding me. I yeah. could not believe.
He was just in town like last week. He was at the Music Box.
But then also Malcolm McDowell. Just yeah. God damn it. I just can't believe what is some of these equations here don't seem to be completed. Just fucking
right.
Joey Lucas. Sorry, not Joey. Joey Lucas is the name of the character from The West Wing. But the actor's name is Marlene Matlin, who is, I mean, you won't get far into her biography before finding out she's deaf. That is kind of a claim
oh,
to fame
sure.
she has.
Yeah.
I hate just making it such a simple thing, but she has played probably the last 20 notable deaf roles
yeah,
you've seen in
anything.
I was
going to say, let's not try to walk the PC line sure. here. If you sure. can be the actor who is the deaf girl,
and I mean great in
I mean,
everything.
Fuck off. That's fantastic.
Yeah, right.
If you can walk into a room and go, did you see that movie?
Right.
Wasn't the deaf girl really good in that? Oh, yeah that's the deaf girl sure. from this
from
movie.
Seinfeld. From,
hell yeah. That's great. Good for her.
God, especially just such a power player in The West Wing, just such a great, great role in that. just scene after scene with these actors. The fucking principal is Ray Wise from Twin Peaks.
And Swamp Thing.
Yeah, it just made me so fucking excited this whole time.
It really says something about these horror movies when they're bringing in these players that are veterans.
Yeah, from other genres too.
Sure. Well, it just, you and I are the type of people that don't really watch a film based on the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to the theater to see a film and they have the one sheet sitting up on the wall,
right?
You know, some people will go up to the one sheet and they'll look at it and go, man, Will Smith looks badass in that movie.
Sure.
That looks pretty good. I'm going to go see it. I walk up to it and look down at the block print.
Yep.
Exactly. And go, M. Night Shyamalan. No, thank you.
Yeah. You've got it.
I mean, I feel like the block print is somebody outlining the actual statistics of the film, going, it's produced by the guy that produced that movie you didn't like. It's directed by that one guy you don't like. It's starring those people that are sometimes good when they're handled by these people who are not involved.
Right.
It's written by the guy who wrote that train wreck.
Well, also, you and I have seen more than 10 theatrical one sheets and therefore realize there are only 10 different styles of theatrical one sheets.
Right.
I'll link off on the site. I am creating so much additional homework for myself this week, but I'll link on the site. There's a really good page of just, hey, here's 5 different types of movie posters. You know, guy with his back to you, destroyed city.
Yep.
People on white, you know, hugging with red font or whatever. They're great. All right. So back to Pauline, because this is the central core of what I want to try and understand if we can get anything out of this conversation. I want to know what the fuck is going on with her and why we like her so much, right? So, a few things about this character. One, a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, greasy, awkward, bad posture. These are things that the film makes a point of highlighting, so they want us to know these things.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about her fucking posture in here. Also, the fact we're contrasting her constantly to her dream state and showing how gorgeous she is,
right,
and the actor's known for being gorgeous. We know that something, you know, socially awkward teenagers, part of that is, yeah, I mean, your skin or whatever, but it's also maybe you don't know how to carry yourself or interact with other people. You have stringy hair in front of your face.
Right.
There's a mixture of hormone and don't understand social normalcy during teenage years that, you know, make them really awkward. And so we know the character doesn't have to be like that. And we see this fantasy world she has for herself. So I think those are things we can relate to.
Yeah.
And maybe that has something to do. Everybody can go, maybe not to this degree, but everybody can go, yeah, I had awkward teenage years.
Mm-hmm.
She also has a disconnect from her parents. Now, you hit on that a little bit in saying maybe they want the perfect daughter. They have between their two daughters a feeling like, you know, if only one daughter could live forever and be this, you know, this great little angel. Do they resent her for that? Where do you think that disconnect comes from?
I think it's probably both of them butting heads against each other, because I think their parents are probably a little upset that Pauline is this perfect, able-bodied girl who's, to their understanding, throwing her life away.
Right.
Meanwhile, her daughter, who could be the perfect, you know, human being, is going to be cheated out of a full life.
Right.
And I think that kind of extra attention to the younger sister is probably grating on Pauline, and she's, you know, feeling unattended to and unloved. And plus, she's not her mother's daughter.
Yeah.
She doesn't want to go to the, I don't remember what the hell they were calling it, but
ice cream social.
Yeah. She doesn't want to go to the ice cream social.
Right.
And I mean, that I think is probably the most natural and normal aspect of the film, is having an outsider for a daughter and not knowing how to connect with them on a level that they're not just going to scoff at.
Right.
There's
also, you know, in being a psychopath, she might represent an extreme end of things that people have maybe only played with remotely in their mind. Something like her obsession with surgery.
Yeah.
Everybody in a very broad sense has had obsessions, But also that obsession with surgery shows how uncomfortable she is in her own skin.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows, I think about the scene where she's marking up her body.
Sure.
And thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to perform, you know, such and such operation on myself. I think anybody who's ever looked at themselves from anywhere, you know, in the range of bad hair day to cannot stand what you look like has thought about, oh, what if I got plastic surgery? What if I look this way? What if I had a different whatever? And so the place where she has an obsession is just the extreme end of something that everybody's thought about to some degree.
Well, and I think it reflects on her. It's her one motion to make good with her entire family.
Mm-hmm.
If she can save the younger daughter's life, she suddenly becomes the greater daughter.
Yeah, right.
And I think that that's just a tantalizing fantasy as well, to be able to take the expectations that your parents have kind of cast aside for you
right.
and go, too bad you didn't believe in me because I just saved our family.
Yeah, she does seem really excited to show, show her mom the attention to detail in her work and the smart plan with which she... God, this final scene, it's so simple and so safe prior to this that once we get there, it does start to feel like the inside or the martyrs level of brutality. And I think a lot of that is just because it's, I mean, at least for me, really unexpected. Was this unexpected for you? Did you see where this was coming? What was your reaction first time you saw this?
It was the kind of thing where, as it was happening, I was kind of going, well, yeah, I knew this was going to be the outcome here. And I figured this is what's going to happen. And it wasn't until her mother walked in and the camera goes, so she did that, that I was like, wait, why? What is wrong with you? You just killed your sister and the neighbor.
Right.
And you shaved your, what the hell is your fucking problem?
So it took seeing the reaction of another normal human being.
Right. I was so
to go, oh, wait a second, this is not okay.
I was so involved with Pauline and her process, because you're sitting there going, well, of course, it's a film. She's gonna work the surgery, and of course, I mean, you know, she's studied, so her sister will be fine.
Aha. I feel like I've caught you in my theory of relatability.
Yeah.
You're sitting there going, uh-huh, totally. No, well, of course you chloroform the neighbor and take out her organs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, another person is here. Yeah, I meant wrong. This is totally wrong. Hi, other normal person. Look at this totally wrong thing happening. I kind of want to talk about this movie for another 20 minutes, but let's talk about the loved ones.
Oh, let's talk about the loved ones.
Should we just lay out the crazy thing right away?
Yeah, I think if we drop it later, it's going to derail everything else.
So holy fuck, The Secret is what I want to talk about. I think it's Sean Brine. Let's pronounce it Sean Brine. That sounds good.
Okay.
Who directed this movie, who we've seen on the show before.
Yeah.
With Rebecca Watson when we covered the movie The Secret.
Yeah.
So can you
hold on. It's a documentary.
No, it's a movie called The Secret. If it were a documentary, it would be by Richard Dawkins, and it would be about how crazy Rhonda fucking Brine is. What was The Secret for people who weren't around for that show?
The Secret is this idea that you can tell the sky that you want an elephant, and eventually you will get an elephant.
Right.
Basically, it's what's their pseudo-scientific term for it.
I don't know, quantum something.
Positive.
Blah,
it's
like, blah.
It's positive. Basically,
positive thinking is what it is.
There's a name for it, but you put out to the universe these good vibes that you want a new car.
Right.
And the universe is forced to, by physical law, to reciprocate
right.
with positive vibes back in your direction, which will only be able to manifest themselves in either a new car or a series of events where you get a new car or you die and nobody knows you wanted a car and The Secret still wins.
Yeah. So as Rebecca Watson pointed out back on that episode,
that is total bullshit.
But we also talk a little bit about why it's beyond not true. It's kind of fucking evil, even though it sounds like, oh, positive thinking is rewarding. That's
sure.
fine. It's kind of fucking evil.
Yeah.
So we talked about The Secret and we totally debunked it and we tore the movie apart and very, very happy about what we did on that show. And then this movie, The Loved Ones, comes out, we had no idea that it was the same director, mm-hmm. one of the many directors involved with The Secret. And I don't know, you know, in my head, I just like to think, oh, he was obviously trying to repay his debt to society. That's why he made The Loved Ones.
Right.
This isn't really a problem for us. I mean, we just talked about Argento, right?
Yeah.
Hollywood is littered with people who think animals can talk to you psychically and that magic herbs do fucking whatever. I mean, we come across this all the time.
Yeah. Well, it would be, we would be insane to think that everybody that makes a movie that we like is an atheist humanist.
We can't
sit down and just expect that every filmmaker we love shares our worldviews, because honestly, they wouldn't make movies as good as they do.
Right.
Because they would make movies as good as your and my movies.
Right. Yep. Although you can guarantee that the atheist humanist filmmakers will find their movies on Double Feature.
That's definitely true. It's not
still waiting for our paycheck from Ricky Gervais. We'll see. That's going to come through.
So we have The Loved Ones, which is a film ostensibly not by an atheist humanist, but who knows?
Well, so this is what I wanted to, and I don't have the information, so I like putting it out to
the universe.
Double Feature Land. Yeah, right. And seeing if doublefeatureshow@gmail.com, if we can get any answers. But Rhonda Byrne wrote The Secret based off the movie she created. She wrote called The Secret, which Sean Byrne co-directed or directed amongst, I think it's a couple directors. I don't know how many. But I don't know if Sean Byrne is, I mean, same last name, might not be related. Could be her son, because Rhonda Byrne is fucking 70 years old or something. Could be husband. I know Rhonda Byrne is divorced. I'm pretty sure she's divorced. So, I mean, I don't know, ex-husband, son, never met her before in his life. Brother. I don't know who this guy is. I do know he made a fucking killer movie called The Loved Ones, which was his, you know, real debut as a solo director. And I also think it's kind of funny that we like to Trojan horse skepticism on the show, and then filmmakers Trojan horse woo into the show where we Trojan horse skepticism because their movie was good.
Well, but did you, so when you told me that this guy was involved with The Secret, did you suddenly start drawing the like hilarious parallels?
I wanted to, but I was so focused on how awesome the movie was that I couldn't mine it for nonsense.
Well, that's not what I mean. But what I mean is, if you take something like The Secret, so we've already kind of discussed what it is and how it should be a wonderful exercise in positive thinking, but it's terrible.
Right.
Now imagine you have a person who lives in a world where her father will get her anything she wants, and she says she wants to go to the dance with this boy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she puts that out to the universe.
Sure.
And she gets what she asks for.
You know what I like a lot better is thinking about, you know, just in complete ironic amazement, how this is a naturalistic horror film.
Oh, yeah.
How what we always see in horror films is supernatural nonsense killer from people who maybe, you know, believe in it and maybe don't. At least some on the show that definitely don't. And now we have this guy who is involved in one of the, I mean, really small number of films we've ever done that's just complete and total bullshit. And he's the guy who's bringing us part of what you were talking about last week as our recent wave of naturalistic horror.
Yeah.
You think there's kind of a lot of that coming out right now?
I think that there is definitely a place for it now. I was talking about last week, movies like The Purge and You're Next.
Sure.
I mean, it's weird because horror movies tend to come out in the summer, and then Halloween comes around and then we're back to our ghosts and ghoulies again.
Sure, sure.
But I think that, I don't know, we've said this on the show a lot. I think that the biggest thing that you can do to scare me in a film is show that people can be horrible.
Sure, sure. A reminder of something that is definitely true, but not widespread enough to remember in our daily lives, maybe.
So when you get something like The Loved Ones, which it bases itself on a scenario that I would say one out of every two people in the entire world comes up with, having to let someone down interested in you romantically.
Yeah, right. I mean,
if not 50%, 100%, you know.
Right. We're getting back to the relatability here.
This is an everyday occurrence. It is an everyday occurrence, not for an individual, but right. for the human race.
Every 9 minutes, someone you love will yeah. get rejected at a dance somewhere.
And it's one of those things that it's one of those few things that I think the human race is not really ever okay. It's one of those things where you go, well, you gotta do it, man. You gotta do it. Right. I mean, it's the right thing to do. You either let them down now or you let them down later when it's more painful.
Sure.
But when people say, well, what's the worst that could happen? Well, they kidnap you and they,
right.
you know, right, nail your foot right. to the floor.
Oh, man. Yeah, the foot to the floor is pretty bad. The urinate in the cup yeah. hammer is the fucking worst. Ooh, it's one of the things scary. I love about the movie is that, one, I don't think there's a shred of nudity in the film.
No.
For a film that is so much about teenage sex and romance and mutilation of genitals.
Mm-hmm.
So to make me think I just watched a really sadistic movie, again, along the lines of something like Inside, and then think back and go, well, yeah, it was bloody, but there wasn't as much genital mutilation.
Sure.
That's really the bar for these types of
well, but movies. What it lacks in genital mutilation, it makes up for in burgeoning incestuous love.
Sure.
You know right. what I mean? Well,
yeah, it's still pushing some boundaries. I mean, this is, after all, it feels like a Splatpak film.
It definitely
it
does.
It sits beautifully on Australia's shelf right next to Wolf Creek.
Right, yeah.
Which, so happy that that's becoming an industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it manages to do it in completely different ways, in different ways from a lot of these Splatpak-type movies, while still giving you the feeling that it did those things.
Mm-hmm.
Replace nudity with incest.
Sure.
You know, still have these torture scenes, but have them... God, I mean, the amount of tension or anxiety I get from this escape that happens in the beginning.
Yeah.
I don't get that a lot in our textbook escape scenes.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, he breaks free after this 10 seconds to urinate thing, which already just was pretty fucked up. But he breaks free, runs out of the house, and in that scene of running out of the house and the car chase and running up the tree, I mean, my fucking heart is going.
Sure.
It's really, yeah. I mean, it's having the impact it is going for.
Well, and we get this other interesting thing that we never see in horror movies, especially on double feature, where the final girl is a guy.
Yeah, sure.
I
could think back to a couple we've done, and they've all been great.
Yeah. And we also get this weird thing where his continuous attempts to escape are foiled because the odds are so far stacked against him.
Sure.
The thing that I think people tend to fall prey to in these survival horror type movies
mm-hmm.
is, in a scenario where it's a woman, we tend to give that, well, she got away, but I mean, it's a dude. He can just, you know, punch her or something.
Sure.
And she's out for the count.
Well, that's the other thing is in this movie, not only is our final girl a boy, but also the killer, the primary killer, I sure. guess, is a woman.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we don't see that very often either,
mm-hmm.
especially in this one-on-one kind of...
Right.
I'm thinking again back to Hostel, again back to there's really just one person. We're not so much picking off people one by one.
Right.
We're just going to capture a guy in the beginning of the movie, torture him for an hour and 10 minutes, and then have some kind of resolution at the end.
Right. And there's this weird inflammatory moment. And I don't know if you saw this for me, but you have this girl and her father, and he's hovering behind her the whole time with this role as the enabler. You know, he's gripping the hammer. He's do what she says or I'm going to fucking beat your nuts off.
Right, right.
And so for me, when he breaks free that second time and he goes for the father and he stabs him in the throat, again, it's probably this idea that horror movies have given me that men can overpower women in a violent scenario.
Sure, that she should lose her power.
Right.
The enforcer's
gone. It's what we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of this, he kills the father And suddenly she's like, okay, well, now all bets are off.
Yeah, she's supercharged at that
point. You've killed my dad, and now there's nobody holding me back.
Right, yeah.
Because I don't have anything to live for now. So you go live with my cannibal ex-boyfriends while I slaughter your family.
Sure.
And that's how we're going to play the next 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah, and that's just the violence. I mean, the other two things I like a lot about the loved ones are... you know, to get back to that incestuous moment and the wondering what the woman at the table, what her deal is.
Sure.
You get the family around the table, kind of Texas Chainsaw vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And once you sort of figure out what's going on with her, you at least become comfortable with her. We open the box, we open the basement, mm-hmm. and we get the what the fuck kind of sounds going on down there. So there is the constant unraveling of what this story is. But then the other thing is, and I don't mean this in a way that detracts from the film at all, but it's kind of lighthearted.
Yeah.
It's kind of comedic, and it's kind of, I think if anything, it gets even lighter at the end. They make a couple extra jokes.
Agreed.
It's the salting the chest wound and the trembling mess of pain that's really kind of the heavy part. Just glitter and pain.
The thing,
so maybe not, I don't know.
The thing for me was the handling of the Dahmer zombie part. So the whole thing where they were drilling the hole in the skull and then pouring the boiling water to cook the brain.
That scene doesn't usually happen. We don't actually see the drill go in very often. We just usually flirt with the idea and then the cable comes unplugged.
Right. Well, so that's, and here's a little bit of my dark knowledge coming out, but that's based on Jeffrey Dahmer, who was a serial killer out of Ohio, who was, he gets accused, and you'll hear this a lot, and it's bizarre because it's true, of having an army of gay zombies in his basement.
What?
He used to drill holes. He was, I mean, you know, he's dead. So there's really no definitive evidence, but he was probably gay. And he used to meet guys at gay bars. This is back in the 70s when that's, you know, a little bit less okay in the public standing.
Sure. And, when the entire earth was less progressive.
Right.
I don't know that there were necessarily less men meeting in gay bars in the 70s, though.
Right, no, but, you know, there were fewer states with legalized gay marriage.
My eyebrows are far more raised at the other thing you're saying, so I'm...
He used to drill holes in these guys' heads and then pour battery acid.
Really?
In an effort to subdue them to do his bidding.
Why have I never heard about
this?
And
he was eventually discovered because one of them got away. So imagine you're walking down the street in Ohio and some naked gay guy with a hole in his head comes running up to you.
Sure.
And starts screaming all this, you know, horrifying nonsense. So now the thing for me is when they're drilling holes in this guy's head and they're going to pour the boiling water in, I'm freaking the fuck out because I know this shit has happened.
Sure. Sure.
And part of me is trying to be the pragmatic science fellow who goes, whatever, if you pour boiling water in the skull, the brain won't feel it.
Right.
And the other part of me is going, don't cook his fucking brain. That's weird. Don't cook his fucking brain. That's weird.
Wow. I didn't know any of this. I'm highly skeptical, but it would be more than you let on the show. You know a lot about serial killers that, for whatever reason, doesn't come up as often as you think it would. I'm going to have to look into this. This is really interesting to me.
It's really bizarre. And so that aspect of the movie to me, again, to juxtapose it against the lighthearted, you need to make the hole bigger, daddy.
Yeah, sure.
To juxtapose something that in my mind is a reality.
Right.
And to goof off with that, that's like somebody using a toy airplane and pretending to fly it into the Twin Towers.
Sure.
You know, like it becomes a lot darker by making it funny.
Were you shouting too soon at your television set?
I don't believe in too soon.
So I do. That's the other great part is right in the beginning, the guy running out into the, you know, into the road.
Yeah.
The Dahmer zombie, I guess, running out into the road. And you expecting that that's kind of the moment where he then death curses them or haunts them or becomes Stephen King's Thinner or something. and later you just kind of find out that was one of the guys. That's, it reminds me of the two kids in the car. it's just a B story. We see it and we go, well, these things must connect because that's what horror movies do.
Yeah.
And then we learn that we probably spent a lot more time with awkward makeout scenes at the, you know, the school dance right. than we really needed to inform the story.
Yeah.
Part of the beauty of the loved ones is we're just going to hang out over here for a while. That's just something we're doing. And then we'll go back to this. I also like where the movie ends a lot. I like that, you know, go home, even with the hole. Once the hole gets drilled in the head, I'm thinking, well, this is it. It's all over. But no, it kind of makes it out.
Mm-hmm.
It goes home, hugs mom, short movie, no time for nonsense. That's where we end. Doublefeatureshow@gmail.com if you know about the Sean Bryan, Rhonda Bryan thing. And doublefeatureshow.com is the site for the podcast. What are we doing next time?
Oh, man, that's a really good question, because even after I answer it, the question is still going to stand. Next time, we're going to do a Todd Solondz, John Waters double feature.
Oh, hell yeah. That would be palindromes and female trouble.
In an overarching female trouble themed double feature. So
awesome.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.